5 FM, WBAI New York, and on the internet at WBAI.org. It is 5 o'clock in New York City. The program you just heard, Labrish with Haptah Selassie, will return next week at 2, following the work of the Midnight Ravers. Now stay tuned for Back of the Book that comes your way right here.
It's probably around 5 a.m.
Yes,
you're listening to all. Oh, do we ever feel lousy? Radio WBAI New York.
No, I know we're not in Kansas.
Good goddamn morning. How the hell are you? This is WBAI New York. The program is Back of the Book. My name is R. Paul Martin. She is Radio Spickles of the North. Good morning, my dear.
Good morning to you, my dear, and a hearty hello to our dear 19 listeners, wherever they may be.
And whatever condition they may be in, because our condition ain't so hot. And we're going to talk about various things here on this program, and you can find a little bit more out about stuff we're going to mention by going up to my website at glib.com, glib.com. You can look around at things up there. When you get to glib.com, you'll see a blue navigation frame on the left-hand side of your screen. At the top, it will say latest Back of the Book program links, and you will be able to click on that, and you'll get to the web page for tonight's radio program. We do a separate web page for every radio program. And the WBAI website and archives seem to be functioning. Now, some of you may have run into a problem last time because for the last program, there was only 32 minutes of the last program in the archive. But I informed people and the webmaster fixed it and put the full program up there. So as of, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, I can't remember what day because we're too sick to remember anything. Anyway, as of earlier in the week, it was fixed. And so the entire last program is in the archives. And we hope that this whole radio program will be in the archives as well. Again, if you ever have a problem with the archives, write to me, rpm at glib.com. And pardon me as I cough on the air, cough on the recording, I suppose, and then it goes on it. Well, whatever. Remember, if you look at the archive and it's not right for some reason, let me know and I'll see if management can fix it. And if they can't fix it, I'll post another archive somewhere else. I'm a mess here. Hey, just say, this isn't COVID, by the way.
By the way, all this coughing thus far, this is not COVID-19.
All right. So, this is our 42nd pandemic episode of Back of the Book. It's pre-recorded. This program was recorded on Friday for airing on Saturday morning. If things have happened between then and when you're hearing this program, we won't be referencing them on this program because a recorded program cannot be as up-to-date as a live program, but this is how we have to do it. In the top news story of the past week for the entire multiverse, on Twitter, we are holding at 108 followers. Oh, boy, 108. The rest of the multiverse is envious of that huge number. And the next public WBAI LSB meeting is scheduled to be held this coming Wednesday, May 12th, 2021, at 7 p.m. on Zoom, even though Zoom compromises privacy and security. And according to the Johns Hopkins website, COVID-19 cases in the whole world reached 156,326,016 on Friday, and global deaths reached 3,260,983. In America, the number of cases as of Friday was 32,643,635, and the death toll in America was 580,804. So 4,959 people have died of COVID-19 in America since our last program 1 week ago. So this week's death rate is slightly higher than last week's. Still, we're under 5,000 dead in America per week at this point in time. And we are seeing a study coming out saying that the real death toll in America may actually be 905,000. And New York City is supposedly going to open up completely as if there weren't a pandemic at all on July 1st. By the time this program airs on Saturday morning, all of the figures we've given you will be higher. And we should note at this point that WBAI producer Mary Ann Miller has died of COVID-19 and pneumonia over the past week or so here. So another WBAI person has passed away in this week. And in terms of all these numbers, that same study that says America may have 905,000 dead, not 580,000, says worldwide deaths are being not tallied properly for various reasons. India is having a tremendous surge. It's third in the world at this point for COVID-19 deaths now, right after Brazil. America is still number one. America, I guess this is part of Trump's America First policy. Yeah, America First, you know, that was also the slogan for the isolationists and the pro-Nazis during World War II. But, oh well, we won't get into that right now. It's continuing. And New York City's going to open up. And Pickles has something to say about this.
New York City is going to open fully in mere days from now. There was an article in the New York Times this week, and I just want to quote from one small part of it. So even though the numbers are down in New York State and New York City, people are still catching COVID and people are still dying of COVID. I'll just quote from this article is New York region is preparing to lift nearly all limits. Fewer young people have been vaccinated in part because they only recently became eligible. And hesitancy remains a daunting hurdle among a significant portion of the population. Public health officials have also said that a big reopening poses inherent risks that variants could spread and the uneven rate of full vaccination could lead to pockets of outbreaks in different parts of the region. Dr. Dennis Nash, an epidemiologist at City University of New York, said the city's vaccination rates did not yet support a full reopening. It just seems poorly thought through and almost a little reckless, Dr. Nash said, adding that, as a result, the city could see spikes in hospitalizations and deaths. I think that the timing is odd, given the serious decline in the rate of vaccinations, Dr. Nash said. Why would you want to push toward opening up when your public health situation is going in the opposite direction? Even so, state, city, and local officials and business leaders across the region have pushed ahead with efforts to resuscitate battered industries and engineer a return to pre-pandemic life. The problem is, we are still in the middle of a pandemic. You said something about this the other day, Arpal. You said that politicians treat the virus the way they do their political opponents, or a problem with their political opponents.
Yeah, they're politicians, and they're used to finagling and making deals and fudging and cheating and lying and getting away with it. You can't lie a virus away. You can't, you know, the real world comes through every time. It's sort of like, you know, people who say, yes, okay, The volcano is erupting and the lava is approaching, but now we'll appeal to the great god Whoopi-Doopi. Oh, Whoopi-Doopi, stop the lava. Oh, Whoopi-Doopi. You know, and that's those are politicians too. And pardon me as I go off in the air. Yeah, this is the way politicians do it. They just cannot generally get themselves to behave as if there are some absolutes in the universe.
And, of course, this is a pee-pee contest between the governor and the mayor.
Yeah, there's that, too.
The mayor says, oh, we're going to reopen everything July 1st. Mayor says, no, we're going to reopen it, what is it, May 19th or whatever. So it's like, oh, great. And, by the way, we're going to open up the subway again. And there's nothing wrong down there, one of them says. Mayor says. The governor says, oh, it's too dangerous. You know, and they're both grandstanding for their own reasons.
Yeah.
And we are the losers, folks.
We are the losers. We are the losers. All right, enough of that. Anyway.
Keep wearing your masks.
Keep wearing your masks. And as we said at the top of this program, we are so ill. And no, we do not have COVID-19. We haven't gotten tested, but the symptoms we have are not that, and we're recovering pretty fast, so it does not appear to be. You've looked into the symptoms and all. You have something about that, but I just want to note that we're really ill, and this middle third is not starting out so great for the two of us. We had been going to go out this week for fun, but then we got ill. Early this week, we got ill, and it started out with a sore throat. I think Pickles was a few hours ahead of me in getting ill, and she got a sore throat. Then I got a sore throat, and I said, it's this little sore throat. What the hell is that? And then it got worse and worse. I started coughing and stuff and feeling, and, you know, you get that achy your head feeling. It became clear after a while. I mean, I thought that I had swallowed a pill wrong. I take a lot of pills. I'm an old guy with medical problems. And so I take some pills, and one pill didn't, you know, it's not shaped in an ordinary way. It's shaped as a lozenge, and it went down wide way down. And, oh, man, that it sticks in there, and it sort of pokes you a bit. And I got it washed down with water, but it was poking me, and I thought that I had a sore throat because some of the outside of the pill had started to dissolve in my throat. Which happens. And, you know, so I thought that was it. And then after a while, though, it started exhibiting those wonderful signs I'm sure we're all so familiar with, where you know it's a germ. And, yeah, so we've had that for days. And it also is part of why, well, it's the main reason why we're actually recording this program a little later than usual. Because I was going to do stuff on like Tuesday and Wednesday and get it all in there because I didn't have any meetings this week, which is a rarity. And so I was going to do all that stuff, but I couldn't do any of that stuff. I was so wrecked. And you think we're coughing and sneezing now. Oh, boy. So, yeah, we've been ill, and Pickles is going to talk about stuff that you can get right about now that is not COVID-19. And Pickles of the North, take it away.
Oh, my. I was afraid it was COVID-19, but Arpal was pointing out, you know, we've both been fully vaccinated, and the odds were really, really against it being that.
Yeah, it's only 0.008%. That's 0.008 of 1% of vaccinated people end up catching COVID-19. It's called a breakthrough virus in that case. But the odds are against us having COVID-19.
Yes, and so then, of course, the obvious thing was, oh, this is just a cold germ. So I started reading up on cold germs because I just wanted to, since we're living in the pandemic society, I thought it would be a good thing to read up about, since we were both feeling so lousy, and it really does incapacitate you, and you think, oh, does a cold really do that? It does, and it can make you feel really bad at any age. So I looked at an article up on scientificamerican.com, and I'm just going to read you a little excerpt from it. And it's called, the article is, Why Some People Are Still Getting Sick, But Not With COVID. And it's written by Marla Broadfoot, and it's from October 2nd, 2020. Some virologists believe that the sheer number of viruses that cause the common cold can make it exceedingly difficult to avoid catching one. There are around 200 different pathogens. These include 4 coronaviruses, the group that includes SARS-CoV-2, 4 para-influenza viruses, which, despite their name, bear no relation to influenza viruses, respiratory syncytial virus, and 160 different rhinoviruses. Viral senses have revealed that dozens of these rhinoviruses circulate in any one place at a given time. You might be immune to the flu, but you are not going to be immune to all those rhinoviruses, says James Gern, a rhinovirus researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. That's one unique feature of rhinoviruses. You are always going to be susceptible to some. But there is only one SARS-CoV-2 virus, and it has proved to be more than enough to wreak havoc on our lives. The persistence of rhinoviruses during the pandemic may be the result of not only their impressive number, but also their primitive nature, says Ian McKay, a virologist at the University of Queensland in Australia. Similar to the flu virus, SARS-CoV-2 is a more highly evolved virus that is enclosed in a fatty lipid membrane. This envelope can cloak the pathogen from antibodies deployed by the human immune system, enabling it to infect cells undetected. But it can also break down after exposure to the environment or a good hand washing, rendering the virus harmless. Rhinoviruses, on the other hand, never evolved an envelope. These so-called naked viruses, which also include the gut-distressing-inducing noroviruses, are more resistant to sanitizers and disinfectants and may last longer on fingertips and surfaces. So the casual contact that we still have during the pandemic exposes us to the rhinoviruses, and our Paul says they can even float in through the window. They're very robust. And in the article, they conclude with the thought that the hope that a rhinovirus does not evolve that is much deadlier than a cold, you know, the cold that it produces, and because that would be, as hellish as this pandemic is, that would be even more hellish. So, well, we hope this makes your Saturday morning a treat, learning about these things. But that's what's been going on with us.
Yeah. That's the big thing. Viruses mutate. They always mutate. I talked about that last time. The reason why they mutate so much is because they don't reproduce, they replicate. And they get into a cell and they make the cell make parts of the virus. And then, pardon me. And then, speaking of the virus speaks. And then the parts kind of just assemble themselves. You know, it's as if you had a junkyard and you had an earthquake in the junkyard and it assembled something. Well, it probably wouldn't assemble a functioning car. It might be a bunch of different pieces of metal stuck together. That's sort of the way viruses work. So they're very changeable. And the, yeah, so if that's always the thing, is a virus that's very successful in getting into us easily, is that going to become something that becomes deadly? Will something deadly take on that ability? This was one of the things that was brought up decades ago when HIV, the retrovirus that causes AIDS, came out. And we were doing radio on that at the time. I was doing radio on that at the time. And we spent a lot of time telling people, no, you can't get it through casual contact. You have to have an exchange of bodily fluids because HIV is extremely delicate. A few seconds in the air and it falls apart, literally falls apart, and is no longer able to do anything to you. And you know, just about everything kills it. So that's why it has to be basically really, really shepherded into your system. That's why people using intravenous drugs and sharing a needle were able to infect each other so very efficiently, because it's just it never leaves a bloodstream in that case. So it stays viable. And we said then, geez, you know, if HIV had the infectious capability of, say, the herpes zoster that causes chickenpox, if it had the same infectiousness as the chickenpox virus, oh boy, you know, that would pretty much be close to wiping out humanity, because it would just spread like crazy, and it would go far before anybody even knew it was there, because it has a very long incubation period, HIV. It takes a while to do anything that causes a symptom. And so in that case, yeah, that would be it for most of humanity, at least. And there's always a danger something like that could happen. But yeah, so we're living with our rhinovirus, probably, whatever it is, and our bad cold. It's not an ordinary little cold. It was a pretty bad cold. And we're living with that, and we're recovering. We're recovering. It's not as bad as it had been. And we'll just have to hope that we can manage to get through this and be better for the next program, when we hope we were not coughing and sneezing on the air. All right, and related to this somewhat, pardon me, is an editorial in the May 2021 issue of Scientific American. And this is an opinion and analysis from the Scientific American's Board of Editors. And the title of this particular opinion piece is Coroners Should Be Abolished. And basically, that's the thrust of this editorial. And it says, I'm quoting some of it here, and the editors say, quote, "The majority of states rely, at least in part, on coroners to rule on the circumstances surrounding unexpected or suspicious deaths. And contrary to what most of us probably believe, coroners are often lay people without training in medicine. What is more, they are frequently elected officials, which makes them susceptible to political pressure from people or organizations looking to influence their conclusions. This system needs to be abolished," unquote. I'm punctuating it with a cough. It then goes on to say that, quote, "A recent analysis carried out for a science news service, STAT, found that tens of thousands of deaths from COVID are going unreported, mostly in counties that supported former President Donald Trump." What a surprise. He didn't really want it to be a major thing. The Republican Party didn't want it to be a major thing. And so they made believe it wasn't there. You know, we have lots of sound bites of him saying, "Oh, this is nothing. We'll be done with it in March or April of 2020. It was going to just go away on its own," and all of that. Yeah, this is some of what's gotten us into this situation we've got now. Well, not the rhinovirus that Pickles and I have, but the pandemic that has killed more than 580,000 people in America. Maybe 905,000 people in America. And the opinion piece in Scientific America goes on and says, "In many counties, the sheriff is the coroner. This arrangement poses obvious conflicts of interest. For instance, in 2017, public radio station KQED reported on the resignations of two forensic pathologists in San Joaquin County, California, who alleged that the sheriff/coroner interfered with their investigations into deaths that occurred during police arrest or custody to protect the officers involved." That certainly shows a danger. There again, politics coming in and trumping, literally, what should be science. And yeah, of course, if the police get to say what somebody dies from and whatever they say goes, you know, gosh, Jesus Christ, George Floyd died of a heart attack because of drugs. That'd be the finding in that case, you know? So, and it'd be the finding in a lot of other cases, and it probably has been the finding in a great many cases down through the centuries. And yeah, I hadn't known that a lot of places have coroners who are not even doctors or anything, that they're, you know, they're guys who are running for dog catcher, and if they couldn't run for dog catcher, couldn't win, they'll run for coroner, and if they win that, then they're in and they get to say stuff, and they don't know anything. You know, they weren't qualified as dog catchers. They certainly can't qualify as coroners or somebody who's going to render a medical opinion in a legal way. But they get to. And so, yeah, I hadn't known that. And this is, of course, something that happens in rinky-dink little joints and various places that have not a lot of money and are usually rural and figure, oh, yeah, we can do it this way. Let George do it. George likes to be the coroner. Let George be the coroner. And George goes and does it. And, you know, George mostly gets drunk all the time. And they bring in a body, and he looks at it, and he says, I'll say he had a heart attack. Meanwhile, half his head is blown off, but George knows why the guy died, and he doesn't want to say. I agree with the editors of Scientific American. Coroners, per se, should be abolished, or else it should be mandated that they be medical doctors. A medical doctor needs to get into this stuff. You can't just have people say, I'm the coroner, and I say this happened, and nothing else mattered.
Who would have thought that there was a difference between having a medical examiner and a coroner? I would never have thought that either. I imagine that bigger cities have medical examiners, and apparently smaller places have coroners.
Although I think they pointed out San Joaquin, that's a big enough place, I think, that they could have somebody in there doing this job, whatever they are, a coroner or a medical examiner, to have a medical doctor in there with real autopsies and stuff like that.
Well, then something is, as you said, very, very wrong with this system.
Yeah. And, of course, those two pathologists, forensic pathologists, I guess they did do an autopsy and came up with findings that the sheriff didn't like, so he said, oh, it wasn't what you said. I say it's this, you know. People dying in police custody for whatever reason, you don't get to find out why they died. Oh, boy. I don't know. I hadn't heard of that one before, but I hope somebody followed up on that. But anyway, there is this stuff going on. And
excuse me.
Oh, I don't. I think we're beyond asking excuse me for even little things like that there, because hell, we're coughing like crazy here, and there's nothing much we can do about it. All right. A very fast little pitch right here. WBAI is listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio, and I know you regular listeners know about that. And we're listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio, and we don't run ads for Chevys, and we don't run ads for, what are all those, for other cars or for stuff that they say, and they make it from shale rock, and you rub it on your face, and it makes your wrinkles sort of go away for 5 minutes, which, by the way, a certain well-marketed hemorrhoid cream rubbed on the wrinkly part of your face will do exactly the same thing as the extremely expensive stuff that they're plugging on TV now. And in fact, I think the people who do it have split into two, because there are two competing commercials with different names of the stuff, but they're the same stuff. I don't know. Maybe they just had a fist fight one night and decided to make two different companies. I don't know what happened, but it's exactly the same thing. In any event, so we ask you to be our listener sponsor. You can be our listener sponsor. You can do that by calling 1-212-209-2950 and saying, hey, I want to become a BAI buddy in the name of Back of the Book. Yes, that's how you do it. You call 1-212-209-2950 and say, I want to become a BAI buddy in the name of Back of the Book, or say, I want to make a one-time donation in the name of Back of the Book. And what you do when you call 1-212-209-2950 and you tell them that, you will be becoming one of our listeners sponsored. Now, sponsors. Now, what is a BAI buddy? A BAI buddy is the name we have for our sustaining membership, which means that once a month, your credit card or debit card, whichever you decide to use, is debited a certain amount. And the amount, you tell them what it's going to be. It can be $5 a month, $10 a month, $15 a month, or $20 a month. One of those figures is what you want to do each month for BAI, and it will help a great deal. And we have BAI buddies now, and they are very, very good because they're a reliable source of revenue. And, you know, again, I've said before, the general manager says BAI costs about $120,000 a month to run. And, you know, we have a lot of expenses, even though we're not at a certain place that was gouging us before. We still have antenna tower costs, which are big. And so there's that. And we have people who are employed. We have rent for the studios, and which we haven't been using all that much for the past year. And so, yeah, we have expenses, $120,000 a month. And so BAI needs to raise that money somehow. And the way we do it is this. We ask you, the listener, to get up, go to your phone, or pick up your phone if it's right next to you since you got one of them thar newfangled phones that's wireless, and call 1-212-209-2950. And say, I want to become a BAI buddy in the name of Back of the Book. It's a good idea to say Back of the Book in there. That way we will get credit for it. 1-212-209-2950. All right, and I'm going to call that an end to this particular pitching session. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper. Ah, yes, The Hollow Men, a poem from long enough ago that it's in the public domain. So I saw something which has updated this particular idea for me of actually the Earth ending. And what happens is I'm going to go over some of this stuff, and I have some updates on some of what I've said before. And we're going to talk about the end of the Earth, which will also be the end of the world, I suppose, at least for humans. And so, yeah, here we go. The first thing, there are several different ways the world is going to end. Some of them with a whimper. I talked before about what if a really deadly disease, like what if HIV were as infectious as chicken pox, but had the same incubation period where you didn't know you had it for maybe years and then suddenly you got sick. Oh boy, which would mean that you would have possibly billions of people infected with it, and it would be too far along before anybody could do anything about it back in the days when HIV was brand new. And it took a very long time to find a way to fight it. These days, HIV can be fought, but it started showing up in the 70s. So it was decades of this thing being fought, but not that successfully. And yeah, so that's one way humanity could go, is a disease could get us all. It may be the way, for instance, the Neanderthals went. They could have gotten a disease and bang, gone. Anyway, these are various ways. One of them, and they're going to go into various chronological orders. All right? The one that's soonest going to the one that's latest and or farthest away in time. First, we talk about Gliese 710. Gliese 710 is an orange star that is about 60% the mass of the sun. And as of research done in December 2020, this small star will come within about 0.221 light years. That's 14,000 astronomical units from the sun. And an astronomical unit is about 93 million miles. That's the distance between the Earth and the sun. So this star is going to come within 14,000 astronomical units of the sun. And that's about 20 times closer than the current distance of Proxima Centauri, which is the closest star from the sun right now. And the approach could actually be even closer. And this star should approach at that distance in about 1.281 million years. So call it 1.3 million years, round it out. No more than 1.3 million years from now, Gliese 710 will get within 14,000 astronomical units of the sun. And at that distance, Gliese 710's brightness would be equal to the brightest planets. So if there are any human beings around 1.3 million years from now, they'll be able to see this thing and they'll notice it in the night sky. It's being estimated that the star would have an apparent visual magnitude of about minus 2.7, which is brighter than the planet Mars at opposition. So that's pretty damn bright. And the star's proper motion in the sky, proper motion is the motion a star, the fixed stars have in the sky. Of course, it used to be thought long ago that they never moved. They were perfectly fixed. And then two ancient astronomers, Hipparchus and Ptolemy, had done maps and done various studies of the sky, and they'd mapped out the constellations and the positions of the stars, and they'd written it all down. But they did it about 150 years or so apart. And as a result, people looked at it and said, geez, did one of them get it so wrong? And they were able to look and say, well, the guy who did it second didn't screw it up. Did the guy who did it in the first place screw it up? And there was a little question right there. And they started wondering, or are the fixed stars all that fixed? Because after all, the planets moved around. Maybe the stars move around too. They didn't know. And so what happens was, after a while, more astronomers studied this interesting topic, and they found that, yeah, the stars are moving around. So that's called the proper motion of a star. And the proper motion of Gliese 710 in about 1.281 million years from now will be about one arc minute per year. And an arc minute is 1 minute of arc. 1 degree, as you all know from high school geometry or some math somewhere, 1 degree is made up of 60 minutes. And so that's what one arc minute is 1 minute of arc. And, you know, it's 1/60th of a degree, which is something you can, you know, it's hard to see with a telescope or any binoculars or anything. It's pretty easy to see that, an arc minute. However, if it's one arc minute per year, that's tremendous. That would make Gliese 710's movement in the sky noticeable over a human lifespan. So if you were a kid and you were looking at Gliese 710 1.28 million years from now, you would look at that and you'd say, aha. And then as you were approaching adulthood, you'd say, yeah, I can see that's in a slightly different place. And as you got to be middle age, you would notice it more. And as you were an old fart, you would be able to say, oh, yeah, that thing has been moving my whole life, and I can see how far it's come. And so it will be quite the sight if there's anybody left to see it. Anyway, Gliese 710 will traverse the outer Oort cloud. The Oort cloud is it's a cloud. It's called a cloud because it's just a big thing out there. It's an area at the outer, very outer reaches of the solar system. It sort of marks the end of the sun's gravitational domination. And it basically consists of a lot of ice and rock, pieces of the original primordial nebula that formed the solar system. And so these things form the solar system, but, you know, things move around. Some of those pieces of ice and rock never came in closer than they are now, and so they didn't form planets or the sun. But planets and the sun formed from exactly that sort of stuff. And so they're out there, and they're various sizes. Some of them are going to be about, well, the size of a snowball. And others are going to be asteroids. And they're pretty much all going to be icy. How much ice versus how much rock is a question. Probably more ice than rock for most of them. And they just form this sphere, which is called a cloud because it forms a sphere. I don't know. This is what they call it. And a guy named Oort discovered it. And so Gliese 710 is going to get into the outer part of the Oort cloud, about 100,000 astronomical units away, and it will reach the outskirts of the inner Oort cloud at its closest approach. So its closest approach is 1.281 million years from now, and long before that, it's going to be at the 100,000 astronomical unit length, and it's going to start disturbing the objects in the Oort cloud, all of these things. A lot of comets come in from the Oort cloud because who knows why. All the stuff out there is moving. It's all in orbit around the sun, and they have gigantic time spans of orbits because these things are under very, very feeble gravitational attraction by the sun, and they're very far away. And so they move very slowly in their orbits, and they're out there. So you have all of this stuff, and again, 100,000 astronomical units away is when it's going to hit it. It's going to travel through the Oort cloud for an additional 86,000 astronomical units. That's quite a distance for a star to travel within this cloud of ice and rock that's just feebly sitting around out there. And although Gliese 710 is only 60% the mass of the sun, that's still a damn heavy object. That outweighs the rest of the solar system outside the sun. And so Gliese 710 is going to be going through the Oort cloud and disturbing things and gravitationally stirring things up. This assumes, by the way, that the Oort cloud forms a spheroid around the sun. They're not precisely sure about the limits of the Oort cloud, but it looks like that. And objects in the Oort cloud are going to be disturbed by Gliese 710 passing through them. And the Earth will stand a pretty good chance of getting hit with some of those icy, rocky objects which are going to be dislodged from the Oort cloud. And that's inevitable. Stuff has to be dislodged from the Oort cloud. It has to be affected. If you have a cloud of smoke and you swing a baseball bat through it, you can see the path that the baseball bat will take through the cloud of smoke because the tiny particles of smoke are being displaced by the baseball bat. So the Earth stands a good chance of getting hit with some of this stuff. Now, that won't destroy the Earth, but it will do harm to living things on the planet Earth, including any humans who are still alive by then. And then, in a time somewhere between 500 million to 1 billion years from now, the sun is going to heat up to the point where the Earth's atmosphere will get thinned out a great deal and will be blown off into outer space, because the atmosphere will heat up and expand and expand, and as it expands, it will get out past where the magnetic field can help to keep it going, and the solar wind will hit the atmosphere and blow it away. This is similar to what happened to the planet Mars. That's what's going to start happening to the Earth 500 million to 1 billion years from now. That'll be because the sun's heating up, and the heat and lower atmospheric pressure will allow all of the surface water on the Earth to evaporate. And at this point, there will be a minuscule amount of atmosphere and no surface water on the Earth. And certainly human life on Earth will be over at that point. Still, the planet itself will endure as a hot, dead rock. Now, we all know that the sun is aging, and eventually it's going to use up all of its hydrogen fuel in about 5 billion years from now. And the sun will then start burning helium. And that will cause the sun to expand into a red giant star because the helium burns. It fuses, really. We call it burning, but it's fusing. It's nuclear fusion. And the nuclear fusion of helium is hotter. And so the sun will expand. And it will expand into what's called a red giant star. And exactly what will happen to the hot rock, which is Earth at that time, is not precisely known. There won't be anything living on the Earth for a long time. The Earth will absolutely, no doubt, be dead for at least 4 billion years before the sun gets to it this way. But we don't know precisely what's going to happen. Right now, it's possible that the sun's photosphere, that's the part that we see, will expand into the Earth's orbit. So the sun will be so big that it will expand to where the outer edges of its photosphere is in the Earth's orbit, and the Earth will be basically gliding through the sun. In that case, most of the planet Earth will melt, and the friction of the Earth with the photosphere would cause the Earth's orbit to decay, and the Earth would fall into the sun and melt away and be distributed among the contents of the sun, which will definitely have already included the planets Mercury and Venus, which are no way going to escape this event. There is, however, the possibility that the sun will not expand as far as the Earth's orbit. In that case, the Earth will be a scorched mess with a lot of its surface just melted. That's as far as we were thinking about the Earth's fate. Well, I'm referring here to an article in the April 2021 Astronomy Magazine in a column named Ask Astro. A question is asked about the Earth's ultimate fate. And the question is answered by Matt Kaplan, who is assistant professor of physics at Illinois State University. And Professor Kaplan answers the question, and then he says, quote, "If Earth manages to survive the sun's giant phase, it will find itself orbiting a hot white dwarf, barely larger than our planet. For eons, Earth will continue to orbit the sun, but eventually, as the sun cools and dims to a black dwarf, Earth's orbit will decay due to the emission of gravitational waves. Over a trillion years, our once blue planet will spiral into the dead sun, a grand finale as the solar system goes dark forever." Unquote. And so, yes, the eventual thing is a black dwarf, which doesn't probably exist in the universe yet because they take a long time to come into existence. But after the sun becomes a red giant, it will burn up its helium fuel, and then it won't have anything more it can burn because it's not heavy enough to burn the next highest element. And so it will have blown off a lot of its mass, because that's what red dwarfs red giants do. They blow off a lot of their mass, and it will stop burning the fuel, and it will shrink. And so it will go from being this big thing that comes out to about the orbit of the planet Earth, a giant star, to a dwarf star, which, again, is about the size of the planet Earth. A white dwarf star is the size of the planet Earth, and it really isn't, a white dwarf star really isn't burning fuel anymore. I mean, maybe a little bit, but not anything appreciable. And it's just got all of this heat, all of this energy in it, and it's just this hot thing. Being of a very high mass anyway, it will retain its heat for extremely long periods of time. And again, it will take trillions of years for the sun to become a black dwarf, which, again, can't have any in the universe yet because the universe is too young. Universe is only like 13.78 billion years old. And so at that point, it's possible the Earth will just spiral in due to losing its orbital inertia because it was generating gravitational waves. Now, gravitational waves, we're putting them out right now. In fact, you put out a gravitational wave when you jump up and down. It's totally undetectable because it's so tiny. And in fact, the gravitational wave detectors can only detect the biggest things going on in the universe, like the merger of two black holes will do it. And you know, black holes are tremendous things. And black holes and black stars are different creatures. Anyway, the idea that this very tiny trickle of orbital energy is going to be enough over time to make the Earth spiral into the black dwarf star that is the sun, that's a pretty amazing idea. That it's gonna be a long time, and the gravitational waves will get to it, which means that eventually, I suppose, other planets will do it too. If the Earth, you know, if we know that Mercury and Venus are going to go at the 5 billion year mark. And if the Earth doesn't also go at around that time, it's going to get sucked in over trillions of years. And will the white dwarf star, that is the sun, be able to eventually bring in the other planets? And the Oort cloud, by the way. That is a question. I don't know if anybody has the answer to that. But there is another way the Earth may eventually just cease to exist as a separate entity. Professor Kaplan goes on to say, it is also possible that what can happen is that the solar system may somehow destabilize a bit. For instance, other stars could approach the sun and approach much closer than Gliese 7-10 is going to do, and that will have an effect on things. And the galaxy is to a degree like a very large billiard table with things bouncing around, except the collisions there are gravitational more than physical things banging into each other. So we could have another star or two come closer and destabilize the orbits of the planets, or something could happen and, say, Jupiter could move around again as it's done in the past, or a black hole could show up. So all sorts of things can happen to make the Earth maybe even get ejected from the solar system and become what's called a rogue planet, in which case it will just float around in outer space inside the galaxy for who knows how long before it ultimately lands in something. Because even with the hugeness of space, if you're given trillions upon trillions of years, you know, you're probably going to run into something. there we have it, an idea of the ultimate fate of the planet Earth. Yeah, none of us is going to experience it, but it certainly is an interesting idea. I found it very interesting that gravitational waves would play a role in one scenario where the Earth ends up crashing into the ash of the sun. That's a black dwarf is really an ash of a sun. So there you go. In other cautionary news, a woman named Karen McBride got married and went to change her name on her Texas driver's license from her maiden name to her married name. That's when she found out that she was wanted on a felony embezzlement warrant. This was quite a surprise to her. It turns out that she had been charged with this crime in Oklahoma in the year 2000. It was alleged that she had borrowed a VHS videotape of Sabrina the Teenage Witch in 1999 and had never returned it. The VHS tape had been rented from a store named, quote, Movie Place, unquote, in Norman, Oklahoma. Movie Place went out of business in 2008. Ms. McBride said, quote, I had lived with a young man. This was over 20 years ago. He had 2 or 11 years old, and I'm thinking he went and got it and didn't take it back or something. I have never watched that show in my entire life. Just not my cup of tea, unquote. She said that she had never watched it at all and had not tried to deceive anyone about it. She even got the title of the old sitcom wrong when she talked about it. So she had this outstanding felony warrant waiting for her for 22 years. The local district attorney in Oklahoma dismissed the case a couple of weeks ago after reviewing it, and Ms. McBride said she had lost multiple jobs over the past 20 years for unexplained reasons. Maybe they looked her up and found that she had an outstanding felony warrant and didn't look past that and fired her. She will now have to sue the state of Oklahoma to clear her record. So this is a cautionary tale about things that can happen to us at any time. And, you know, even something like the store could have just not recorded that she brought it in right. Some clerk made a mistake at a store 20 years ago, and she has a felony warrant out and has lost jobs over it. Oh, man. Oh, there's Mr. Outro music. Okay, that's been it for Back of the Book for this week. Thanks a hell of a lot for listening to this sickness-riddled version of Back of the Book. We'll be back here next week, and we hope we'll be much better. Coming up next, we're not totally certain what's coming up. It usually is the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, but the schedule had said that there was a fundraising special, but now the schedule says the fundraising special isn't going to be there. So we don't know what's coming up next. Who knows? We do know that Jim Freund is preempted this week, so at 7 o'clock, you'll be hearing Women Fight Back, and that will be on at 7 o'clock. All right, we hope you all stay healthy out there. We're going to hope we can get out this next week and be not sick this next week. Take a look outside. It's looking very spring-like there. It is mid-spring now. And look out. Enjoy that. Get out if you can. Get vaccinated if you need to. And above all, remember what that coughing and sneezing and hiccuping and feeling lousy Dormouse said.
Hi, this is Hannah from WBAI's Premiums Department. As you may know, WBAI now has a new phone number to call to make donations or to pledge for premiums at 212-209-2950. Thank you for being a WBAI member and for making a contribution to keep the station afloat. But if you have a question about a premium, please do not call that number. All the call center can do is take down the info and send it to premiums@wbai.org, and time on the line costs us money. Instead, please email us directly with your question or concern. The email is premiums@wbai.org or call 212-209-2870. We promise to get back to you within a week's time. Again, please call 212-209-2870. 2870 if you have a question about a premium you ordered, or email premiums@wbai.org.
Hi, this is Doug Wood from Green Street, heard every Tuesday morning here on WBAI. At most radio stations, the focus is on advertising, ratings, and profits. Here at WBAI, the focus is on people and issues. We don't have advertisers, and while that provides us with editorial freedom, it also means we depend on your financial